from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Remember The Matrix, that 1999 sci-fi thriller where the characters dodge bullets in a computerized world while their bodies rest safely in the real world?
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
The idea of being sucked into a simulation, a virtual reality, has definite entertainment value. Now therapists and doctors are taking that concept one step further. They're using sophisticated software to help patients work through stress, improve muscle movement, and ease pain. Today on Radio West, virtual reality in real-world medicine. Coming up after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. There's no question that violence and depravity abound in many video games, but digital media is also proving to be a very useful tool in medicine. Neuroscientists and psychologists are using virtual reality therapy, sometimes called VR therapy, to treat a whole host of conditions, from post-traumatic stress disorder to burn treatment to stroke. Researchers and practitioners are finding that virtual reality can increase physical mobility and ease pain. Today on the program, we're taking a look at the medical uses of computer simulations and how the line separating the physical and the virtual worlds continues to blur. Joining us on the program, Albert Skip Rizzo. He's a clinical and neuropsychologist and the associate director of the University of Southern California's Institute for Creative Technologies. He's also a research professor in psychiatry and gerontology, and his research centers on designing virtual reality therapies for clinical assessment, treatment, and rehab. Skip Rizzo joins us from KPCC in Pasadena. And Professor Rizzo, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Also with us on the program, Hunter Hoffman. He's the director of the Virtual Reality Research Center at the University of Washington's Human Interface Technology Lab. He's a cognitive psychologist and research scientist who focuses on medical applications of immersive virtual reality. And Hunter Hoffman joins us from KUOW in Seattle. And Dr. Hoffman, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments about virtual reality therapy. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. Gentlemen, before we get into the particulars of how virtual reality is being used in medicine specifically, I'm wondering how each of you found yourself in this place. How did you get interested in using VR as a therapy tool? Let's start with Dr. Rizzo.
Well, it started with my clinical work in the early 90s when I was working in brain injury rehab, and I noticed that a number of my clients were enamored with computer games, and these were folks that were very difficult to motivate to do traditional cognitive rehabilitation, but they loved playing games. And some of the games they were playing were, things that you could say would enhance cognitive ability if played a lot. So when I started seeing that, I started bringing in things like SimCity on a Nintendo 64 and having them work on that. And at the same time, virtual reality popped into the public consciousness, and I started thinking, if we could integrate VR simulations with the motivational aspects of computer games, then we might have something that would motivate our patients to do the kind of cognitive exercise that would be a benefit for the rehabilitation. And since that time, it's just grown from there, from the cognitive area to work that we do in psychological treatment, physical therapy, and so forth.
Nintendo 64, you're dating yourself there, Dr. Rizzo. Professor Hoffman, how did you find yourself in this field?
I started using virtual reality to study human memory. I was interested in confusion between fact and fantasy, and virtual reality was a very exciting way to manipulate fantasy, memories of computer-generated events. While I was studying that, I was approached by a therapist who had a patient that wasn't responding to treatment for spider phobia, and we put together a virtual reality world to use Spider World to expose the patient to various scenarios with spiders, and that went extremely well. So that was a very encouraging first experience.
I want to get into the particulars of that particular bit of your research later in the hour, but I think we probably need to lay some groundwork about what we mean by virtual reality. How does virtual reality differ from, like, the over-the-counter games like, I don't know, Mario Kart or Lego Star Wars? You can tell where my kids are spending their time. How does it differ from the Wii games or the Nintendo games that we're familiar with?
Okay. Well, I look at any kind of a computer game that you navigate in a three-dimensional space, even with a gamepad or a mouse and keyboard. Those are essentially virtual reality environments. However, they're not very immersive. You're just sitting in front of the screen and you're driving in that window. With immersive virtual reality, you're actually more encased in the stimuli and you're more of a engaged participant because, for example, if you wear a head-mounted display that's tracked to your head movements, as you turn your head and look around in the environment, it's as if you're in that environment. So when you want to make that comparison, I like to use the analogy of the difference between looking at a fish tank from the outside versus just diving on in and swimming with the fish. I think there's different types of virtual realities, different levels of immersion, different levels of interaction. The Wii, for example, provides a useful 3D user interface, a tool that allows you to interact in a more natural fashion compared to what you would do with a mouse or a keyboard or a gamepad. And so VR is sort of I see it as a mixture of this kind of 3D graphic simulation that you can interact with from the outside, or you can interact more naturally when you're immersed within it.
Dr. Hoffman, how long have we been using virtual reality in medicine? I imagine the history's pretty short, given that the technology's, you know, rather recent innovation.
I think the early uses were in simulations of surgical simulations and medical applications. When it comes to actually using it with patients, I'd say around 95 was some of the earliest work with using VR for exposure therapy for treating phobias. And the pain research was shortly in that mid-90s as well.
So you mentioned some headgear and things. If I am going to a doctor's office for some virtual reality therapy, what can you describe physically what's going on, what you're attaching to my body to allow me to enter this virtual world, Dr. Rizzo?
Well, it's a combination of the type of display and the type of interaction device you use. So if you go into an office and you're getting exposure therapy, the ideal method for doing that is to immerse the patient in a virtual world where you can systematically move them closer to what they're afraid of, but at a pace they can handle. So they would put on a head-mounted display and they'd be able to turn their head and look around and move about in the environment. Sometimes they might use a joystick or a gamepad just for navigating in the environment, but they, as they move their head and look around, they're actually the graphics, the 3D graphics update in real time with their head movement. So they might be put into, like what Hunter's doing, I'm sure he'll talk about this with Spider World, an environment where the therapist can control the provocative nature of the environment. And we do this as well with PTSD, with returning soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, by putting them in simulations of Iraq and Afghanistan and moving them through the scenarios that gradually help them to confront their traumatic experiences in an emotionally constructive way.
So if there's no delay in movement, is there any ability to get dizzy or nauseous when you have this gear on?
You know, that we've in the very beginning days of VR, when computers weren't very fast, there might be a little bit of lag as you turn your head, and it would take a few extra milliseconds for the graphics to catch up, and you'd see a bit more of that. But with the speed of computing and the fidelity of some of these devices now, we're seeing much less of that. Of course, there's always going to be maybe 10%, or the numbers vary, that are still somewhat affected, but it's a short-lived kind of a thing, and I think it's no more provocative for most folks than going on a cruise liner.
Professor Hoffman, there are already simulated worlds out there like Second Life. Do you foresee a time when a virtual psychiatrist will set up a virtual office in one of these virtual worlds for virtual patients? Do you see that maybe that's where we're headed, that kind of interaction? Would it have the same kind of therapeutic value that we see in a face-to-face session, or even a telephonic conference?
The current setup for treating phobias and PTSD, the therapist is already more or less meeting the patient in a computer generated world. They're also usually in the same location, but yeah, often the patients have the illusion that the therapist is there in a rock world with them or in spider world. I think in terms of Second Life, one of the big advantages that of Dr. Rizzo's work and mine is the illusion of going inside the computer-generated world, and that's much stronger with when you use these technologies like the VR helmet compared to just conventional networked VR like Second Life.
There's been a good bit of work in this area, though, with the telemental health approaches. And, as with any area in clinical care, you've got the good and the bad. One of the really strong features is that if you've got a patient that has difficulty getting to your site, this provides a useful alternative, whether it's because they live in a remote location or they may have a disability that makes it challenging for them to get to the clinic. On the other side, you've got to be careful that there's some kind of structure or monitoring to make sure that it's done in an ethically sound manner. But there is research that's coming out just recently in the journal Behavior Therapy showing that you can effectively do these types of therapies as long as the controls are in place from a remote location. And when you think about Second Life, if the illusion is strong enough that both the patient and the therapist feel co-located in the same environment, then it's just a matter of perception, whether you're physically there or whether you're psychologically there. And as you know, in actual talk therapy, there's people aren't touching, so there isn't the need for the physical touch. I think the real concern is, what if the patient has a challenging moment? Would it be better for the therapist to be right there with them, or can they handle that situation from afar? So there's risks and benefits on both sides, and people are doing the good research to sort this out.
Do we physically know what's happening in our brain when we're in a virtual world, and how is that different from when we're in the physical realm that we all live in? Do either of you have a take on that? What's happening chemically in our brain? Do we process information differently? Do different parts of our brains light up when we are in a physical environment as opposed to a virtual world? Dr. Hoffman?
Well, I can't answer that directly, but we've done some fMRI brain scan studies with patients that are in virtual reality versus with no VR, but during painful stimuli. So we were specifically looking at the effect of the virtual reality on pain perception and pain-related brain activity. And what we found is that people when they're in virtual reality are so drawn into the computer generated world that they spend less time thinking about their pain, and we found dramatic reductions in pain related brain activity.
I think there's a need for further research in this area. I know that there's quite a bit of work being done measuring changes in the brain following virtual therapy. We just completed a study that was published in the Annals of New York Academy of Sciences with PTSD patients that had brain scans before and after exposure therapy, and you saw real changes in how the brain reacted to emotional stimuli when in the virtual world compared to before treatment. So you saw changes in the direction you would like to see in how the brain reacts to traumatic stimuli. But how the brain constructs a perception, comparing that based on how a brain constructs perception of reality versus VR, I think there's a lot of great work to be done in that area. I think in the clinical area that we're focusing in, you know, where there's, you know, you're always struggling to be funded, we're trying to focus more on, can we build something that actually works clinically? And I think it'll be up to more research, neuroscience-focused folks to start looking at, well, what's actually going on in the brain? And some of that early work is quite interesting, but it still is, I wouldn't hang my hat on the findings at this point. I think we still have a ways to go.
Today on the program, we're talking about virtual reality therapy and how technology is shaping medicine. If you're a doctor, do you use VR treatments in your practice? If you're a patient, what's your experience been with VR? Give us a call. 801-585-WEST is our number, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, using computer simulations to promote healing and improve health. If you have questions or comments about VR therapy, you can give us a call. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. With us on the program, Skip Rizzo. He's a clinical and neuropsychologist, associate director of the Institute for Creative Technologies at USC. Also with us, Hunter Hoffman, a cognitive psychologist and director of the Virtual Reality Research Center at the University of Washington. Just leafing through some of the research on this, it appears to me that virtual reality therapies seem to kind of group themselves in three different categories. One is pain relief, two is improving motor skills, and three is in mental health issues. I want to kind of go through each of those. Perhaps we can start with the pain relief. And Professor Hoffman, you've been exploring how virtual reality helps burn patients. And when I first read your experiments, I didn't see the connection. But as I delved further, it looks like burn patients have an incredible amount of pain, and the VR treatments seem to divert their attention. How did you get to that point, thinking that distraction is an effective pain relief?
One of my friends, John Everett, was working with Dave Patterson. Dave Patterson's a hypnotist at Harborview Burn Center in Seattle, and when I asked him, John, how does hypnosis work? He speculated that distraction was part of it. And I said, well, if you want a distraction, I've got a distraction for you. So he set up a meeting with Patterson, and we just tried out using virtual reality with one of the kids over at Harborview Burn Center. And even our very first try, it immediately worked for reducing the child's pain. So we've since made quite a bit of progress in developing a virtual world specifically designed for treating patients to distract them from their pain. The problem with burn patients is especially during these wound care sessions. So a severe burn patient has to have their bandages changed and their wounds cleaned typically every day. And they also have physical therapy exercises to stretch their newly healing skin. And both of those are very painful. But the good news is both procedures typically last around a half an hour, depending on the size of the burn. So it's not like they're in pain all day. The big problem is just trying to reduce their pain during these, you know, 20 or 30 minute procedures. Mm. So the what we do is have the patient go into the computer generated world. There's a natural tendency to want to escape from pain. So we give the patient a place where they can go. And you were mentioning earlier the difference between a video game and an immersive VR. I think this is one area where the fact that your view, that the helmet blocks the patient's view of the real world, is unusually helpful in this case, because the real world is looking at this nasty burn and also the nurse and other patients in the room that might be groaning in pain, for example, that are all not unhelpful for the experience of the patient. So the patient interacts with the virtual world. They throw snowballs at snowmen, penguins, igloos, woolly mammoths, and they get special effects feedback and sound effects, and they can hear music from Paul Simon playing in the background. So all of these multi-sensory stimulations lure the patient's attention into the computer-generated world, leaving less attention available to process incoming pain signals.
Is that what makes a successful simulation, kind of having a goal? You know, you're throwing snowballs at something, or is it just the surround sound and all of the visual stimuli being targeted in one area? Is that can you just talk briefly about the game development part of it?
Yeah, Dave Patterson, Sam Schar, and I here at the UW, University of Washington in Seattle, have done a series of laboratory studies to isolate which factors are most influential in reducing the pain. We found that the interactivity is very important. The quality of the VR goggles is surprisingly big factor. So wide field of view goggles that have a lot of peripheral vision really help. And then the one factor that was a big surprise was the head tracking, where Skip was mentioning earlier, when you can move your head around and what you see changes. For example, if you physically lean back in your chair with head tracking, you would look up in the sky. We were surprised to find that the head tracking really didn't help pain reduction in our study. So that's freed us up to use some new helmet technologies like this robot-like articulated arm goggle holder, so the patients don't even have to wear a helmet. They can just look into these immobilized goggles and still have a strong pain reduction. That's proved very popular because a lot of the burn patients have head and face burns, so it's uncomfortable to wear a helmet.
We're speaking today with Professor Hunter Hoffman. He is a cognitive psychologist, director of the Virtual Reality Research Center at the University of Washington. Also with us, Skip Rizzo, a neuropsychologist and associate director of the Institute for Creative Technologies at USC. And today on the program, we're talking about virtual reality therapy, the limits, the benefits. 801-585-WEST is our number if you'd like to join us. And let's go to the phones. Joan is with us in Salt Lake City. Joan, welcome.
Thank you. The question I have is, I'm wondering if any research using this type of technology has been done with autism, with children with autism, particularly those who are apraxic or have poor social skills.
Good question. Dr. Rizzo?
Yes. There's early work that's being done where, in a virtual environment, you can begin to interact with virtual people. We're actually working on developing collaborative games where two children on the spectrum have to interact physically, not with each other, but with the game content in a cooperative way in order to achieve the aims of the game. Some of the early work has been done with developing characters that are appealing to these children and putting them in settings where they need to ask questions or in social settings and so forth, and giving them some practice in the virtual world for the kinds of skills that would be helpful in the real world. And that, you know, it's a very challenging population, and I think I would say that the work is still in the beginning stages, but I think it offers a heck of a lot of potential, particularly with some of the new interface technologies that are coming out where you don't have to wire people up to interact with them, and the use of artificially intelligent virtual humans in virtual worlds that can actually interact in a fairly credible way with the user.
Joan, does that answer your question?
Very much.
Okay. Thanks for calling. 801-585 West is our number. 801-585-9378. These applications are targeting very specific conditions. We just talked about autism. We talked about pain relief. Let's move to motor skills. And how is virtual reality being used in the rehabilitation of someone who has had a stroke, for example, or is dealing with cerebral palsy or other conditions? Dr. Huffman?
Actually, I think that's a good question for Skip.
Okay.
I think with any of these conditions, the first thing you have to realize is that in traditional therapy, we know if we go beyond the current care as usual approach, which typically involves once a week for an hour for, you know, 5-10 weeks, if we go beyond that and do it intensively, do the physical therapy intensively in a targeted manner, we do see not only changes in brain function, but we see improvements in functional everyday abilities. So where VR comes into the mix here is to produce environments that are engaging for the user so that they're going to be more likely to do their physical therapy and adhere to the typically boring and repetitive regimen that traditional therapy involves. We at USC, we have what's called a Rehab Engineering Research Center, sponsored by the National Institute on Disability and Rehab Research, which focuses exactly on this. The big challenge is to be able to track the user's physical movement in a relatively high fidelity manner so that they're actually practicing good movement in the virtual environments, in these game-like environments. So folks have played around with things like the Wii, for example. You occasionally hear the term Wehab or Wehabilitation. And I think there's some potential there, but the challenge is a lot of times there's not the science behind it. A lot of times therapists may say, you need therapy, go get a Wii and take it right out of the box and use the games with it. Mm-hmm. And that really is not an effective and useful approach. It might be good for exer gaming, for getting someone more active, but for the precise motor movements that are needed to do physical therapy, you need to go a step beyond it. The more exciting area now is with the Microsoft Kinect, which is a camera system that actually tracks full body movement, and we've been doing work with that for the last year, where the user stands in front of their television and the camera actually tracks their body movement and puts it in a game environment that the clinician can adjust so that we can systematically deliver the kinds of challenges in a game context that is going to be beneficial for their improvements in motor function and hopefully brain change that will continue to drive better functional abilities.
You talked about the effectiveness of, you know, people actually doing their physical therapy and in some ways making therapy fun.
Yep.
At least tolerable. Are there people who don't especially respond to VR? Young versus old, men versus women. I don't know if those things have been studied yet, but are those things that you might be looking at?
Well, our rehab engineering center focuses on aging with disability. So we look specifically at people as they age and they have perhaps spinal cord injury, brain injury, they've had a stroke and so forth. And to our surprise, when we do quite a bit of user studies, we found that the older population enjoys playing games. It's no longer how we used to think in the 90s that this cohort of older folks are not going to adapt or uptake the technology. They'll be resistant. I mean, there are some folks that they're not interested. But for the most part, they enjoy games, and very similar to younger folks, they like games with a story. And this is a key element. When you asked Hunter earlier about what it is about VR that might draw a person in, having narrative, having a story involved in the game or VR simulation area seems to be real helpful in engaging the user to continue to participate and get more involved in the activities that they're doing. So with older folks, and now the current, the future older folks, which I'm going to be one of them soon, we grew up with this stuff. And so it's not a foreign technology to older people now.
Does it make a difference if the avatar looks like you?
Not really. People suspend disbelief. If you look at some of the avatar characters in the Kinect avatar application, you know, they're cartoon characters. People can suspend disbelief as long as there's good interaction with the environment.
801-585 West is our number if you'd like to join us. We're talking about virtual reality therapy with Skip Rizzo. He is a neuropsychologist and Associate Director of the Institute for Creative Technologies at USC. Also with us, Professor Hunter Hoffman, a cognitive psychologist and director of the Virtual Reality Research Center at the University of Washington. 801-585-WEST is our number. 801-585-9378. And let's go back to the phones. Linda is with us in Pleasant Grove, Utah. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, thank you. Your question, comment?
Well, my question is, I've got a daughter who's 25 and has had fibromyalgia for about 4 years. She's, you know, every day she just tries to get from one place to the other because she's in so much pain, which, you know, it's hard when you have little children. Mm. But, you know, pain meds can only do so much without, you know, affecting your ability to function. But also the depression that comes for these folks that are suffering. Have they done any work with people with fibromyalgia or those types of things?
I don't know. Gentlemen, Professor Hoffman?
I think there's some very early research trying to figure out how to use virtual reality for that patient population. That's a chronic pain, and I think the most obvious use of VR for pain is for short, you know, brief, painful procedures, so it's more challenging. Dr. Patterson's beginning to use VR with chronic pain by combining it with hypnosis, so that using virtual reality to hopefully enhance the effectiveness of hypnotic suggestions. So that's one potential avenue for treating fibromyalgia and other types of long-term pain that just continue to be painful, you know, for hours at a time.
Linda, good luck to you, and thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST is our number. I guess that sort of begs the question, how widespread is virtual reality therapy? I mean, is it hard to find a doctor who does this? Dr. Rizzo?
In the L.A. area, there's at least two therapists that I know that have VR setups for everyday clinical practice in psychological disorders, treatment of phobias and PTSD and so on. It really depends on the clinical condition and where the if you're close to a major city. I mean, the uptake is not dramatic in the sense that every therapist has one, because it's still sort of novel technology and people are still waiting for clinical trials to document its effectiveness in some areas. In the areas where it has been proven to be effective and there are the resources to do this. We're seeing good uptake, like, for example, our virtual Iraq PTSD treatment application is currently at 55 sites around the country, VA medical centers, military clinics, university clinics, and so forth. And pretty much, you know, if you have PTSD, within a range of where you live, you would be able to probably get that treatment. But it's still on the way up. I think we're hitting a tipping point now where we're starting to see the clinical results come in and document that we can add value with this technology. And I think that it's just going to continue in that direction.
Let's go back to the phones. Don is joining us from Provo, Utah. Don, hello.
Hi. About 10, 15 years ago, I attended a pain control workshop at University of Utah that was done for midwives and childbirth teachers. And they were talking about engaging all of the senses in order to help to, you know, divert pain and actually, you know, keep you from perceiving part of the pain because you're sort of on sensory overload. And one of the things that they pointed out that is really powerful that we tend to not pay much attention to is the role that odors have, that strong smells, especially ones that bring pleasant memories, play because it's, you know, in an older part of the brain and it has a really powerful effect. And I'm wondering if odors are incorporated into any of these programs.
Don, good question. Thanks for the call. Other senses involved in the VR therapy experience, smell, touch. Dr. Hoffman?
We are using touch for treating spider phobia. So we have a mixed reality spider where when the patient reaches out to touch the virtual spider in the virtual world, their real hand simultaneously touches a furry toy spider. Their brain unifies the sensory input, and they have the illusion of physically touching the virtual spider. And we've done studies showing that doubles the effectiveness of the exposure therapy treatment. The patients who received touch were able to approach a live spider twice as close. You know, it's interesting, the two types of applications we've been talking about, pain, distraction, and treating PTSD and anxiety disorders. In one case, we're using virtual reality to allow the patient to escape from an unpleasant environment with Snow World for pain distraction. With the VR therapy, we're using the same virtual reality technology to help the patient confront an unpleasant situation or object. So actually, Dr. Rizzo's used it for in smell in the second class. Maybe Skip, do you want to tell them about?
Sure, thanks. Yes, with the virtual Iraq Afghanistan simulations for PTSD, we have a smell machine that we use along with a base shaker platform. So with the base shaker platform, we run the sound from the program through these subwoofers that are in a kind of a plywood platform that the user's chair is sitting on, and the sounds of the motor then become vibrations, or if there's a bomb that goes off in the distance, you feel it through your body, and users report that dramatically increases their sense of being in the virtual world. Now, with smell, we do the opposite of what your caller did. We don't have nice flowery smells. We have smells that are more relevant to the types of things somebody might experience in a combat environment, the smell of gunpowder, cordite, burning rubber, diesel fuel, rotting garbage, body odor, those kinds of smells. And again, while we don't have specific data on how it impacts clinical treatment efficacy, we haven't done those kind of studies because we're basically throwing everything but the kitchen sink into the simulation to get the effect and getting it. But some users are particularly primed. They may see the visual stimuli, and that sort of sets the stage. But when they hear the sound and feel the sound, and when they get a certain smell, it brings them right back to where the event happened, and it unlocks a flood of emotional memories that, when done in the context of good exposure therapy, is very beneficial and helpful for the patient. Mm. So I think the multisensory environment is definitely an important area for maximizing treatment benefit with these tools.
Don, thanks for the call. Well, we're talking about virtual reality therapy and how doctors and therapists are using simulations to relieve pain, both mental and physical. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. This hour, virtual reality as an analgesic. What do you think about using computer simulations as a prescription for relieving pain and healing? Join us with your questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378, or send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another call. Rebecca's calling us from Camas, Utah. Rebecca, welcome.
Yes, I was wondering if they're making use of the effects of music. I suppose that would be more for anxiety, depression, you know, people who are seeing the world in an ugly way. And just wondering if music is used. I have a background in this and know what a powerful effect it can have on the brain. And just wondering if that's part of the therapy.
Okay, thanks very much. Dr. Hoffman?
We do use music, and I think it is quite helpful contributing. We use Paul Simon's Graceland and several other songs by Paul Simon simply because he came by our lab once and offered to let us use it. And it kind of gives an upbeat, atmosphere to Snow World, and we combine that with the sound effects of the shattering ice when you hit a snowman and it shatters in 3D, or the sound effects of when we throw snowballs at a woolly mammoth, it trumpets angrily. So I think the sound effects are really important, the converging evidence from multiple senses, and the music definitely adds kind of an upbeat atmosphere too. And, you know, we actually measure how much fun patients have. We're the first ones to start measuring that, and we're finding surprisingly high fun levels during wound care sessions. With no VR, patients rate their pain typically as zero on a scale from 0 to 10 on how fun it was. And during VR, we often get 7 or 8 people saying their wound care was pretty fun. So that feeds into the idea maybe in the future, once we, we're in the very early stages of figuring this all out, and it's amazingly effective already. And I think as the technologies improve, we may someday see a day where in 5 or 10 years where some of the patients at least are actually looking forward to their wound care.
Yeah, I think this is what makes working in this field so fascinating, is that there are so many of these different types of questions and stimulus elements that we have to work with. And it's really a game changer, I believe, in the areas of psychology and rehabilitation and so forth, because, you actually can see a time where therapists can orchestrate stimuli in virtual worlds to meet whatever the specific needs of the patient population may be. So, in the case of music, there's so much richness there, so that perhaps I've heard of some groups developing relaxation scenarios that are designed specifically to help somebody with, say, hypertension or other stress-related disorders to be able to relax, and selecting music and orchestrating the stimuli and making it so it can be individualized to the needs of a specific user. It's just a wide open field for people to explore, something we were not capable of doing prior to the mid-90s, early 90s.
I love this idea of researchers measuring fun levels. That's a great term. But there must be, or maybe there's not. Are there downsides to virtual reality therapy? Is it addictive? Do people get bored with the same scenarios after they've used them before? You know, are there downsides to virtual reality that you've been able to measure yet? Dr. Rizzo?
Thus far, I think, geez, I'm always focused on why it works, but the immediate downside that you can point to is that some folks believe that the cost of the equipment is a deal breaker, but that's no longer true anymore. I mean, I deliver virtual environments off a common laptop now with a low cost head mounted display that are effective. So the costs aren't there. I think it's only up to the user's personal experience. Some people may feel a sense of loss of control in those environments. Sometimes the loss of control may be part of the therapy, and that's what you're encouraging someone to let go. I don't see it being addictive at this point. As a famous guy in VR once said, it's not good enough to be addictive. Perhaps that will happen in the future. You know, I mean, you see this with online games like World of Warcraft, where you know some people give up 6 hours of their day to play World of Warcraft, which is essentially an exotic, expansive virtual reality environment online. But you know, when something becomes an addiction or a passion, it's hard to say. If you know somebody played violin for 6 hours a day, you'd say, "Wow, that's devotion." If they play World of Warcraft and get really good at it, you say it's an addiction. So you know, it's a lot of value judgment in those areas.
You mentioned about the cost to doctors to invest in this kind of equipment, but what's the cost to patients? Does insurance, does Medicare, does Medicaid pay for this kind of virtual reality therapy, Dr. Hoffman?
We currently are only using, with pain distraction, we're just letting the patients use it, providing it. Usually it's some fundraiser has raised the money for their burn center, and the burn center then uses it, or maybe NIH-funded research. And I think Skip can talk about the VR exposure therapy and using insurance for that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it always comes down to, with insurance, are you delivering an evidence-based treatment? And to the credit of the field, most folks, when they develop VR applications, start off with evidence-based treatments or theory-informed treatment that they want to improve or be able to have better access for patients to get at. And so if you do exposure therapy with VR, it's still exposure therapy. There's nothing magic about VR. It's just another tool for perhaps delivering exposure therapy in a more effective or more engaging way that will draw people in. We see this with PTSD, with soldiers and Marines and so forth, that they are more likely to seek PTSD treatment in the virtual scenario, a certain subset of the population is, than simply doing it the traditional way, sitting face-to-face with a therapist and so on. So I think the key take home on this is that it's not VR therapy. It's, in this case, it's exposure therapy using VR. So insurance companies, like they would pay for any exposure therapy treatment. This one just has an added tool.
We've got 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to ask each of you, is VR therapy, is it augmenting traditional methods of therapy, or is it replacing them? And can virtual reality therapy accomplish what doctors alone can't do? Let's put that to you, Dr. Hoffman.
This kind of feeds into your earlier question about addiction. With virtual reality pain distraction, we're using it to augment, using it in addition to conventional pain meds. So the patients get their pain meds that they would have usually received, but then that's not enough to reduce their pain alone. So we use the VR on top of that. interestingly, with respect to the addiction, you know, you're talking about narcotics as the pain meds. So it's in some ways VR, you could see VR as reducing the use of addictive substances if we're able to refine it so that we can eventually reduce the dose that's needed for patients, including soldiers, who respond well to VR.
Dr. Rizzo, is VR replacing traditional therapies, or is it a new marriage, a new partnership?
It's a new partnership. I have no doubt in my mind that VR is a technology. Technology, if you look at the root definition of it, is talking about tools. It is a tool that can extend the skills of a well-trained clinician. We're not eliminating good clinical practice, good clinical skills, good clinical training. We're giving a clinician a tool to do their work better. It can be complementary, it can supplement what they do, but it still rests on the ground truth principle that good clinical practice is at the core of treating patients with clinical disorders.
So it doesn't look like VR is going anywhere. It's here to stay.
Yeah, and it has a bright future. I mean, we're doing now the next generation of VR, and that is actually populating these worlds with artificially intelligent human characters. We've built virtual patients that doctors can now practice with. They can practice therapeutic skills and so forth. And this is the next generation of VR, and it's definitely not going anywhere except into the clinic soon.
Skip Rizzo, he's the Associate Director of the Institute for Creative Technologies at USC, also with us Hunter Hoffman, Director of the Virtual Reality Research Center at the University of Washington. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. The executive producer is Doug Fabrizio, and I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.